Okay, well, welcome back after the summer, and welcome to the new folks.
Oh, here, yep.
Anyway, I've been working for some time on these Maldacena dualities, Greenwich Avenue dualities with reduced supersymmetry, and most of you have heard at some length about the work I did with Matt earlier this year. And over the summer, there have been some new developments, which are interesting and in some ways kind of surprising. And so I'd like to, the most interesting being a paper by Klebanoff and Strasker. And so I'd like to today just give kind of an overview of the subject, both the new work and the old, well, especially the new work, but the new work and the old work, and how they fit together. So the basic idea is one starts with the Maldacena duality between string theory in a rather symmetric space and then once one has this duality, in a variety of ways one can break the symmetry on both sides. And be left with, on the string side, 2B theory in a less symmetric space. And on the gauge side, some n equals 0, 1, or 2 supersymmetric gauge theory. So a non-supersymmetric or with at least reduced supersymmetry. And just a few words first about the motivation. As with all dualities, information flows in both directions. In this direction, you learn something about the gauge theory. You can do calculations over here, and in effect solve a large N gauge theory. So you can solve some large N gauge theory. Get a quantitative description of its spectrum and everything else from the supergravity. In this direction, and I'm focusing on sort of the theories of less supersymmetry, one of the most interesting things, and I'll say a bit more about it in a second, is you learn something about what string theory does with singularities. And also, interestingly, this ADS5 appears also in Randall-Sundry factorification. It's a space with a large work factor, and so you also learn something about Randall-Sundrum in string theory. So those are the motivations, and a bit more. First of all, your real goal, of course, the ultimate goal, would be to fulfill a Tufts program and solve large N QCD. And it's clear that you're not going to solve large N QCD with the current methods. And let me explain why that is. It's well known, but it's complete. Let me just write down for you the coupling is a function of energy. G squared Yang Mills N is a function of energy for QCD, for large N QCD. It's asymptotically free. One, and it blows up at some energy scale lambda. And the point is that because it's asymptotically free, the effective description from this energy on up is just a perturbative gauge theory. You'd like some kind of quantitative dual description of this scale where you have confinement and chiral symmetry breaking, but the problem is that this scale is really only a small factor, 2 or 4 in energy, from a scale where the perturbative gauge theory takes over, so you don't have any big parameter which will allow some new approximation to be valid, and so you, because again, the theory is perturbative at an energy very close to the confinement scale, there's no hope for a quantitative dual description of the physics here. That's in this current framework where what we really have is one effective description in one range and a different effective description in another range, some crossover region in between. I mean, that's the basic tool that we're applying all over the place. We need something more than that, something which is a real solution in some sense to go further. Okay, so what, having said that, what do the current duals accomplish? What they all do is they take the theory that you want, which is like QCD, or maybe n equals 0 or 1 QCD, and they add matter in such a way that you never get into this perturbative regime. You add matter in such a way that the high energy theory is essentially conformal, the beta function turns over, and you stay in the region of large and Tuft coupling, where you can have a supergravity description. And I'll describe actually three different ways of breaking the symmetry, all of which correspond to adding different kinds of matter, and they're interesting for different reasons. But okay, so you can see from this picture sort of what you can hope to do. Because this scale, this is the scale set by the new matter. Because you can see from the picture that the new matter, although it's massive, although at some scale it decouples and some interesting infrared physics happens, it's massive, but it's not decoupled because I can't take this scale and move it to high energy because these things have to meet where these things have to meet before this drops to one. So you're adding massive but not decoupled matter. In such a way that the high energy theory is conformal but not asymptotically free. So that's what keeps you from getting to QCD. Nevertheless, these are real four-dimensional quantum field theories for which you have honest supergravity duals, and they're conformal field theories which exhibit the kinds of behaviors that you have in QCD, including both confinement and chiral symmetry breaking. So these are interesting four-dimensional quantum field theories which have a quantitative string dual description. Okay, so that's the gauge theory motivation. In the other direction.
But in all these cases, if you have control over string theory in these backgrounds,
yeah,
we could decouple the matter.
Well, okay, so I'm going to say a few words at the end, but there are so few that I can say them now. Right, to decouple the matter, you need to pull this scale up to infinity, which means that the short distance theory, right, is okay. From the supergravity side, the reason that the reason that you can't find a dual is that the dual description is useful only when the space is large compared to the size of a string, only the parameter is large. Right. So in order to get a dual description of this theory in which g squared n is zero asymptotically, you would need to understand strings moving in a space smaller than themselves. Let me say just a few words. Again, I don't have much to say about that, but at the very end, I'll say a little bit more.
But Joe, this doesn't preclude the fact, the possibility of having a supergravity dual for the confining regime.
Well, but again, the confining regime starts. Well, this, in some sense, everything happens here. Down here, you have nothing. Everything is massive or nonlinear signal model. The scale at which everything happens is here, and it's so close to here that there's no small parameter that would allow a new dual description to take hold if you had asymptotic freedom. So you really need something that goes beyond anything that we're currently doing, which in some sense, when this parameter is small, it means the world sheet theory is strongly coupled. The curvatures are large, so the space is small, the curvatures are large, so the world sheet theory is strongly coupled. You would really need methods for handling a strongly coupled world sheet theory. Now, we have them in some cases when the world sheet theory has a large chiral symmetry, a large current algebra, but so the hope would be that when the world sheet theory is understood, it will be some world sheet theory that maybe has enough current algebra or something that would enable you to get something. It won't be current algebra. but that would be the hope, that it has, that you have a worksheet theory that has enough structure that you can solve it, even though it's strongly coupled.
No, I mean, as far as this goes.
Yes.
These a different set of four-dimensional theories before you try to take this limit. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're not much different than the other constructions of QCD. Well, I break into the symmetry right now.
Yeah, I was going to mention,
conceptually, there's not too much of a difference. So these might offer more hope in taking this part of the limit.
No, let me come back to that, because I was going to mention all of that, right. Let me continue with the story about singularities. So you start with ADS space, whose radial direction has a horizon and a boundary, and you perturb. And what happens pretty generically is that when you break the symmetry, you find that the horizon becomes a naked singularity, at least in a naive supergravity treatment. And of course, the thing that Matt and I found was that in one case, due to this Myers dielectric mechanism, string theory resolves the naked singularity in a particular way, namely, the singularity gets blown up into some kind of expanded brain configuration. Through the Myers dielectric mechanism. And you've all heard about this at great length. The interesting thing is that in the Klebanov-Strassler, so just this is Polchinski and Strassler, Hepf. You all, I think, know this. And then the interesting thing is that in another context, which I'll describe, the singularity is again resolved, but in fact, it's resolved purely within supergravity, and in an interesting way. So I don't know how to draw this, but purely within supergravity. The singularity is resolved. Okay, this is a new paper I want to talk about, Klebanov and Susskind.
Ten dimensional, not five, but
10-dimensional supergravity. That's why I can't really draw it. I was trying to draw something which was anyway. right. The real surprise is that it seemed as though this was some kind of universal mechanism, and it's not. In some cases, string theory does something which is kind of more mundane, in the sense that there's no explicit brains involved, it only involves supergravity fields. So one reason for doing this exercise is just to identify universal features that might survive in a dual description of QCD, and it's interesting that this, as it stands, is not really a universal feature, because it's already not present here. But it's interesting to ask in what sense this might be, well, we'll come back to that, what if any universals there are between these two descriptions. Okay.
Sorry, is it clear that these are two totally different kinds of answers? I mean, in certain situations where you have brains, you can think of an analogous supergravity configuration, if it's something like a five-brain, which is a non-singular gravity configuration.
Well, let's see, all of the brains regarding the supergravities have either singularities or horizons or places where the Dolopan diverges. So even if I think of this as a supergravity description, this is really, this is really a smooth supergravity. The curvature is everywhere small, and there's no step, there's no horizons, no singularities.
It's like the distinction between a two-brain and a five-brain.
I'm sorry?
It's like the distinction between a two-brain and a five-brain in M-theory, that one is sort of...
But they both have horizons. They both... Wait, I think this is got... It's not near these... No, this is just...
It's true that the classical solutions for both the two-brain and five-brain in M-theory have non-singular horizons in 11 dimensions. The difference is, when you go through the horizon, it's a singularity inside or not. And in one case, there isn't, and in the other case, there isn't.
This doesn't even have a horizon.
It doesn't even have a horizon.
Doesn't even have a horizon. And then the final motivation is trying to realize Randall-Sundrum in string theory. Let me just mention the closest, well, so in Randall-Sundrum, you basically just look at the five dimensions. You've got ADS5, and one, you have the horizon or the IR brain, and the boundary is cut off and replaced by a Planck brain. And in string, and then the other five dimensions, if you're going to end up in string theory, you've got to go along for the ride in some kind of constant shape, like S5. It's pretty clear that, from a sense of looking, this has no direct realization in string theory, in which you simply have a product solution. The closest anybody has come is Verlinde, who, for example, says, suppose we take something like T6 mod Z2, just some convenient six-dimensional states, and put a bunch of D3 brains together, then locally, you've got a product geometry, which is ADS5 plus S5, but as you locally near it, as you move away, you don't have a direct product. Rather, this end is replaced by, again, a genuinely 10-dimensional geometry, where the radial direction and the five you didn't want to talk about mix together. Nevertheless, morally, this is the same as Randall-Sundrum. It has, you know, you don't call it a bound state graviton anymore, but it has a graviton and it has a low energy conformal region. So morally, it has the same physics as Randall-Sundrum. And okay, again, both at the infrared, both at the ultraviolet end and at the infrared end, where the singularities get resolved, the physics becomes fully 10-dimensional. So unfortunately. It's fun, the game in Randall-Sundrum, to play with these five-dimensional space-times, but in fact, if you really look for a realization in string theory, then both in the UV, where you have to find something that plays the role of the Planck brain, and in the IR, where there is some singularity that in the end will be resolved, the geometry is fully 10-dimensional. And for that reason, this makes real string theory model building quite a lot harder because you are then dealing in the full complication of Calabi-Yau spaces and now with Wolf factors and so on. So this realization of Verlinde has n equals 4 supersymmetry, but you can imagine replacing this with some kind of less symmetric, more generic Calabi-Yau to produce something that whose low energy end will look like the theory that I'm about to describe. Okay, so the first step is to start with Maldacena and break the symmetry, and I want to describe the three different routes by which this has been done. The first is just to perturb at infinity, perturb the boundary conditions, and if you do that on the supergravity side, then we know from Witten, Gubser, and Klebanoff that corresponds to perturbing the Hamiltonian, so it takes its conformal form plus some perturbation, and for example, the perturbation can give mass to the parts of the n equals 4 multiples you don't want, reducing you to n equals 0 or n equals 1 gauge theory. This, of course, is the story with math, and that this is the story where on the supergravity side you have some kind of free-form field which blows up brains via the Myers effect. So this is again, you've heard about ad nauseum. So in this context of adding matter to make the theory conformal, the matter that you add here is simply the complete n equals 4 multiplets, which are being split by this mass term. Now, the more interesting recent, by the way, this has one annoying artifact that is absent in the Klebanoff-Strasser paper, which is that there's no chiral symmetry. One of the annoying aspects, these theories seem to have a fair number of artifacts, which are really artifacts of having the x or n equals 4 matter. And again, one of them is that there's no chiral symmetry. you can, the mass of the sector, for example, the N equals 1 theory, has an R symmetry that rotates the Galeno, which gets spontaneously broken. You got to see that on the supergravity side, but unfortunately, embedding N equals 4 explicitly breaks that chiral symmetry. So the nicest new feature of the Kleinhoff Strasser paper is that it has in fact chiral symmetry breaking, chiral symmetry and spontaneous breaking of the chiral symmetry. This is a small perturbation. Second thing you can do is a large perturbation, which is to replace the 5 sphere with some other Einstein space. So another space whose Ricci tensor is proportional to its metric. And so you still have a solution, which is ADS5 cross X5. That still solves the field equations. But in general, there is always less supersymmetry. And the two X's I'll talk about are just some orbifold of the 5 sphere, some identification of the 5 sphere, like S5 mod Z2. And the other one is this famous T11 manifold, which I'll describe to you briefly, which is SU2 cross SU2 cross U1, which is topologically, I can't see this, but it's true. This is topologically a 2-sphere cross a 3-sphere. Okay. And so the number of supersymmetry depends.
It's like a Hopf vibration, right? SU2 is S3.
Yeah.
And S3 is an S1 bundled over S2. So
that's less obvious, the direct product, and it won't play a direct role in anything I do.
I assume the U1 doesn't act on both the SU2s, but if that could just on one,
then it would be trivial.
Then it would be easy to see.
Right, if it just acted on one, then that would be an S2, and that would be an S3. It acts on, well.
It acts on both.
It acts uniformly on both. The 1-1 means it acts on both. There's MNs where it acts in different proportions on the two. Right. And so there, you look for conformal Killing spinors on these two spaces, and this has 2, so it gives you N equals, this by itself gives you N equals 2 supersymmetry, and this has 1, it gives you N equals 1 supersymmetry. Now, there's one more ingredient though, because as it stands, I said that you get a solution which is ADS5 plus some Einstein space, and that means since there's ADS5 component, this theory is still conformally invariant. So these theories, although they have reduced supersymmetry, they're in this special class of theories which are still conformally invariant. So you've got to do something else to break the conformal invariance, and that's the following. In addition to this, let me try. I told you T11 is a product, and so I'm gonna draw it like this. I'm just gonna draw the two factors side by side, even though they're of course in orthogonal directions. One thing that you can do is to turn on the 2B theory has the 2B theory has free-form fluxes. And you can turn on some free-form flux that's quantized on the S3. So this is some, let's just say it's the Ramon free-form flux. That's what it is. You can turn on the Ramon free-form flux on the S3. What that corresponds to is the following. The ADS space we can think of as being secretly created by a bunch of D3 grains living at the horizon. What they really do is they don't live at the horizon, their quantum fluctuations fill the space. But classically, over very long times, the D3 brains live at the horizon. In this space, you've got this 2-sphere, and so you can have a D5 brain. You can have a D5 brain which wraps the 2-sphere, it's extended like the 3 brains in the directions, and if you hide some of those wrapped D5 brains at the horizon, they produce this flux. So this is due to wrapped D5. It's interesting that this theory starts with D5 brains, but in the end you just have, in the end you just have smooth supergravity. You don't see those, you're not going to see those D5 brains in the final resolved solution. Okay, so you have these wrapped D5 brains heading to the origin, they produce this flux. This does break the conformal symmetry in a way that I'll describe in more detail later on. I won't tell you right now what the gauge theory is, because I was going to do that in more detail later. Okay, and the third way of breaking the symmetry, which is what David was referring to, is to start with a different duality, ABS7 cross S4, whose conformal dual, whose dual is a 5 plus 1 dimensional theory, the 0-2 theory. And now to get down to a 3 plus 1 dimensional theory, instead of mucking with the 4 sphere, we muck with the 6 non-compact directions. So you wrap 2 of them on a 2 torus with appropriate supersymmetry breaking boundary conditions or some other Riemann surface. And again, when you break enough supersymmetry, in any of these three cases, the theory is confining. There was no discussion, was there, of conformal symmetry, of chiral symmetry in this context, was there? I remember a lot of discussion of confinement, but. Yeah. Okay, well, actually, there now is. So the other recent paper I wanted to mention.
You were doing pure QCD.
You were not trying to get to something which had fermions, right? Okay, good.
So you didn't have matter in fundamental.
Well, if you wrap it on an S2, then this is Maldacena and Nunez. And this is an easy number to remember. In this categorization of these theories by having added matter to make them conformal at high energy, of course, this has a lot of added matter because only very low energies does it look like a 3 plus 1 dimensional field theory. So unlike these cases where you've added just some additional 4 dimensional fields, here you've added an entire 6 dimensional conformal field theory, which again might in some ways seem worse, but it's not clear what the metric is. In terms of eventually getting to an understanding of QCD. One reason that this is interesting is that, in fact, this Maldacena and Nunez solution is very similar to the Krebenhoff-Strassler solution that I'll be telling you about. Their UV completions are different, but their infrared ends and their symmetry realization are directly parallel. Okay, I'd like to understand this one better. I've thought much more about this one. But
so why did they? You mean when they do it on S2? Why S2? What is S2 by?
It breaks supersymmetry. As compared to the twisted nitrogen on T2, it partially breaks the supersymmetry. It leaves n equals 1. Which again, you don't need. You want to understand n equals 0. It does leave n equals 1. Putting an S2 as opposed to a Riemann surface of negative curvature gives you less matter. This has kind of the minimum amount of matter at low energy. I'm not sure what happens when you fully break supersymmetry, but when you're left with...
Why is there a minimal amount of matter? Because the
matter comes from the non-trivial one. When you quantize the fields on this space, the matter comes, I guess, from the non-trivial one-forms on the non-trivial vector fields on the compact two dimensions. I have to think about why that is. But you don't have them for S2, and you do have them for any other Riemann surface. We're talking about 2D fields. So...
But you still have all the coordinates are fine.
You have all the fluids of fine. No, it's just the massless sector. It's just the very massless fields here. Right. So all three of these realizations, say the turning on n equals 1 masses, or this realization, well, this realization here, actually, no, sorry, I would, yes, this realization here, or this one here, the very lightest matter is pure n equals 1 supersymmetry. So these are all theories whose massless matter is pure n equals 1 supersymmetry, pure n equals 1.
Whereas if you do T, twisted T2, it's...
Twisted T2, I mean, in twisted T2 is interesting because the, how did that work? Not everything got masses at tree level, but because supersymmetry was broken, you argued that in the end...
Twist T2 and the fermions get mass.
Presumably from Lewis.
Then you break supersymmetry completely.
Right, right. I don't know. Let's see now. Can you detect T2 and break only some supersymmetry? Well, as you go around the circle. Yes, if as you go around the circle, you rotate by something on the S4, which is, you know, lives in. There might be a realization like that. Yeah. Okay. But so again, this one you've all heard about ad nauseum, when I recall, at least a bit. And again, you know the story with the Myers mechanism. And what I want to talk about again is to give sort of an introduction to this class of theories, which are more interesting for several reasons. So, what I want to do, I think, is to start these two examples, the overfold and the T11, are close cousins to one another. And so I want to start by describing this one, which you can understand rather more explicitly, and then to just sort of start waving my hands towards the end.
So what's the modification of the ADS-5 in this case? Because you don't have a three-spirit around.
Here.
Yeah.
Well, you sort of do, because when you have a Z2 overfold singularity as a hidden two-sphere,
you're going to have some fixed.
Let me start describing. So this is where you have D3 brains in the 0, 1, 2, 3 directions. And then you overfold it. To overfold in a way to preserve the supersymmetry, except with V2, you reflect four directions. So you simultaneously reflect these. So you have a Z2 overfold singularity. And just to be a bit pedagogical, let me remind you how it works with D brains on an overfold singularity. I guess these two dimensions here are, for example, the 6 and 7 directions, so that the reflection takes you from here to here. And I'm not going to draw, of course, the directions in which the D3 brains are extended, because they're just extended. But if I have a string, and I've got a couple of D brains on which the string ends, then the reflection takes this into a string over here. And so, in addition to the, this is sort of one copy of the space, and this is its image under the reflection. So if I want to have n D brains out in this space, I really need 2n Chan-Payton degrees of freedom, 2n endpoint degrees of freedom. And so if I have some string, it has some wave function where I can sort of say which of these 2n D brains each end lies on and its internal state. And this reflection operation takes this open string, and it reflects the internal state, but of course it also acts on the Chan-Payton indices, because it moves in at the endpoint, which was here previously here, is now here. And so this matrix I've called gamma is just the n-dimensional identity and the n-dimensional identity, because it takes these are the n d brains. and these are their images. Although, which is a D-brain and which is its image is, of course, not an invariant thing. Okay, now, if you take this, so what you want to do is you take the original string theory with two N D3 brains, which would have an S, which would have a U2N group, and now you restrict the states which are invariant under this, and then you are left with some subgroup of U2N, which is in fact UN cross UN, with two hypermultiplets in the NN bar. Okay, and that's again straightforward perturbative string technology, just keeping track of how the reflects. It also reflects the oscillators. So psi is the oscillators and I and j are the endpoints. This is just straightforward perturbative string technology, figuring out which string states are invariant under this reflection, and that's the answer. And again, this is a conformally, the reflection breaks half the supersymmetry, and this is a conformally invariant n equals 2 theory. Now, you can do something a little more general, which is first, there's nothing special about this basis. You can instead work in a basis in which this matrix is, okay, this is just a conjugate matrix. And again, this basis doesn't have the pictorial interpretation in terms of the D-brains and their images, but it's just a good description of the states. So now you can do something else. You can consider a more general case where you have N1 plus N2 Chan-Peyton indices, and this acts on the Chan-Peyton indices again in the same way, but now with asymmetric numbers of positive and negative eigenvalues. And for the sake of argument, just for the sake of definiteness, let me suppose that N1 is greater than N2. Now, if you try to think about what this means back in this other basis, or if you take the moduli, so let me first of all say what you get over here. It's kind of obvious. You get UN1 cross UN2 with the hypers again now in the, well. Okay. If you look at the flat directions in the potential here, which correspond to physical motions of the D-brains, you find that you can move N2 of them, the smaller number, off of the singularity in this way. That is, N2 move this way, and their images move the other way. But there are some of them, N1 minus N2, which are stuck. And these are called fractional. Fractional. D3 brains. So this more general way of putting D3 brains on a Z2 overfold produces these fractional D3 brains, and this is no longer a conformally invariant theory. The larger group is asymptotically free, and the smaller group is free in the infrared. So if we graph the two coupling constants, then the one which is free in the infrared will blow up at some energy in the UV, and the one which is free in the IR, I should be saying SU because the U1s don't do this, but so I should actually separate this into, of course, the simple parts. So on the gauge theory side, you have two gauge groups, and one of them blows up at low energy, and one of them blows up at high energy. And this is a one-loop statement, but because this is n equals 2 gauge theory, the one-loop beta function is the whole story. And so this is what the theory, this is what the gauge theory does. Now, so it's not conformal.
They're all instant-time collections.
I'm sorry? There are instant time corrections, yes, which become important, which are not important when GN is, Right.
John, which corresponds to which? There are the brains you move out of a single the origin.
Okay, good. Let me actually, let me explain that, because there's another way to think about these stuck brains here, which is this orbifold space secretly has a zero size two sphere hidden at the origin. This is T4 mod Z2 can be blown up into an ALE, an A1 ALE space, where this conic singularity instead ends on a small two sphere. And there's a simple interpretation to these stuck brains. These stuck, what you thought were stuck free brains, what in the orbifold description are just stuck free brains, are secretly N1 minus N2 D5 brains wrapped on the tiny two sphere. So two of their dimensions are wrapped, and three of them you see. Okay, so when I was describing to you the fractional brains in the more geometric description, we had some five brains hidden at the origin. Here also, we have five brains hidden at the origin, but they arise through this funny property of orbifold technology. And one way to think about this system here.
So in what sense are they fractional?
Because one way to think about this system here is that you have, I think I need to write, yes, N1, yes, N1 and M2 if you actually sort of ask what are the basic constituents of this system, the natural basis, the things that can move apart, in fact, are these things, where you have N1 D5 brains and N2 anti-D5 brains, and each of these D5 brains has half a unit of D3 charge for a reason that I'll describe shortly. Okay, and this adds up correctly. The total D3 number is N1 plus N2 over 2, which is right. The one half comes again because half of these have to be thought of as images. And the total D5 depends on the asymmetry N1, N1 minus N2. And by the way, even though these are D5s and anti-D5s, you can separate them. You can separate them along, or you can separate them in the 4 or 5 directions. And there's no attractive force. And the reason is because these five brains are being wrapped on a zero-size sphere, and so they sort of carry no weight. They don't couple to anything that would pull on them. Okay, so Curl asks the question: you know, what are these two things? The UN1 is the gauge group of these objects, and the UN2 is the gauge group of these objects. Okay, so this is all sort of the perturbative string side. That is sort of the free spectrum and the free limit, and then also its geometric interpretation. When you remember that a Z2 singularity really has a limit of a geometric space. The next step is to find the supergravity dual to this gauge theory. So you need to find the solution to the field equations, which has these quantum numbers. So many units of D3 charge, so many units of D5 charge. Klebanov and Nekrasov did this for N1 minus N2 small. So for N1 minus N2, much, much less than N1, Klebanov and Nekrasov found in that approximation the supergravity solution, because in that approximation it's basically you have mostly D3 brains, so it's the usual ADS5 with some perturbation coming from the freeform flux produced by the five brains. Actually, one of the things I've done is I found the exact supergravity solution, which I won't describe now, but later I'll describe it as a special case of a more general set of solutions that also includes the Kravinoff-Strassler solution. But I'm still talking now about the X5 mod Z2 theory, and I'll get to T11, which again is a close cousin to this theory. But I want to finish the story on what happens here, and figure that there is a singularity, and I want to sort of describe to you how it's resolved. So I can approach this from either end. I guess I'll approach it from this end. How can we see in the supergravity solution? How can we see in the supergravity solution this behavior of the coupling constants? Because that's sort of the most striking thing in this theory. Well, it comes back to this 1/2 unit of V3 charge and where that comes from. One of the things we learned a long time ago about this idea that you could blow up a Z2 overfold into a small two-sphere is although the two-sphere has zero size, it carries on it a two-form field. The integral over the two-sphere of the Nevot-Schwarz two-form field is sort of half, or pi, which is halfway between 0 and 2 pi. This was the observation of Aspinwall, which resolves various paradoxes. So what happens is, what you really have on the singularity is the wrapped V5s, but we know, of course, that a higher dimensional brain gets lower dimensional charges when it moves through background form fields, and in fact, this anti-symmetric tensor background, which is hiding in the A1 singularity, is the source of these half units of V3 brain. Charge. Now, when you go to the full supergravity solution, I'll write down the field equations now. I might use them later, but there's the Ramon 3 form. There's the Nevot-Schwarz 3 form. Tau here is the usual pi over g string plus theta over 2 pi. And the divergence of g3 is the 5 form. Write that a little more neatly. The divergence of g3 is the 5 form wedge g3. And the divergence or the curl of the 5 form, doesn't matter since it's self-dual, is G3 wedge G3 complex conjugate. Anyway, as a consequence of this field equation, this is becomes radius dependent, and it becomes radius dependent in a rather extreme way. Although it's just logarithmic, it blows up at large r, and it blows up at small r. And in fact, the pi is no longer even really relevant because I can absorb it into what I call r naught. So I've got theta of r, and again, theta of r is now something which, as we go through, it goes. Well,
where does this come from?
This comes from this field equation, which basically tells you that if you take this and solve it, you find that the corresponding potential is logarithmic.
Yes, it wasn't decoupled from the rest of the universe,
back reaction and well, you're kind of getting ahead of me, but since you asked, I'll answer you now. In the approximation of coming off of Strassler, this is a first order thing. This is zeroth order. It's from the D3 brains. This is first order. They solve a linearized equation and get this. Now to the next order, you have to include the back reaction. And I'll tell you what the answer is, because it turns out the back reaction is essentially trivial. The sources for the 5 form and the metric due to G squared are exactly proportional to the sources due to D3 brains. So in fact, the full metric, both here and for Kravinoff-Strassler, the metric and 5 form and dilaton are all just like the E3 brain Higgs branch. in spite of the fact that you have this G3 flux, and the G3 flux then just satisfies a linearized field equation because the warp factor drops out. Yeah. For some reason, life is very simple. Not only here for n equals 2 case, but this is hidden in the Kovanov Strasberg solution. Okay. What time is it, by the way?
1 o'clock.
Okay. Okay, so the B field does this. And now let me come back and these fractional brains are V5 plus theta of R over 2 pi times V3 and V5 bar plus 1 minus theta of R over 2 pi V3. And again, that's because the V3 charge is just induced by the coupling of the form to the 5 brain, and because the form is a function of radius, so is the induced B3 brain charge. As the 5-brain moves in radius, of course, what's happening is it's leaving 3-brain charge behind in the fields in the fashion described by Wadi. But the interesting thing is what happens when theta, as we go down in radius, what happens when theta goes to 0? Or as we go up in radius, what happens as theta goes to pi? Well, when theta goes to 0, this guy becomes massless. The D5 part is massless because it's wrapped in a zero-size sphere. And this part is massless because theta is going to 0. So if you go down in radius, the kinetic term for these degrees of freedom goes to 0, which is the same as saying that the coupling diverges. And when you go up in radius, the same thing happens. So this solution, how to say this? This solution has, so you see, this is how you see in the supergravity. This is how you see in the supergravity the behavior you expect in the gauge theory.
It looks like it's happening at finite radii, though.
It's happening at finite radii because it's happening over here at finite energies. Right, energy is, basically energy is radius, and so.
It's not an asymptotic state. Richard.
No, this blows up like QCD.
Landau-Pohl.
So, right. Now, actually, in this theory, you can, go past the Landau-Pohl. You really need to think about not just these things, but their bound states with some number of additional B3 brains.
In the gauge theory, the singularities are resolved by the instant.
Yeah, now here the instant times don't play a direct role.
Why don't they play a role? N is big.
Because their coupling though is e to the minus, they're effectively e to the minus 1 over g, and g is the order 1 over n, so this is the order e to the minus n. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I took n big when I started talking about supergravity over here. That's right. In fact, the final picture, I don't want to dwell too much on the n equals 2 theory because I want to have time to get to the n equals 1.
The radius is related to what? The n 1 and 2? I mean, what is the alpha prime corrections governed by?
The alpha prime corrections, what suppresses them is n1 minus n2 over n1. Squared, because I think, I'm sorry.
Does nothing can lose the difference, right? That's
what I'm going to. No, because the curvature, the question is how big are the gradients? And over here, this gauge theory is nearly conformal. G is of order 1 over n. G is of order 1 over n. Gn is fixed. And so this whole thing is small. This whole thing varies slowly as long as n1 minus n2 is small compared to n1, basically. And in that case, the alpha prime corrections are small. Actually, there is...
But there are alpha prime corrections even in the conformal, it's not that there are alpha population just goes with one of the square root of n, which has nothing to do with the T wave line.
Right, but this is all, yeah.
This is on top of the usual.
But this is all at law. I mean, there's the usual alpha. These are just the lowest order supergravity field equations. But when GN is large, but also when the difference is small compared to N1, you need both of those. Then these are good approximations. Anyway, if you try to actually sort of build this object that has so many units of D5 charge, so many units of D3 charge, you find the best you can do, because you can't push something past the point where it goes massless. This is very similar to the system that Amanda and Clifford Johnson and I discussed.
So, you were about to say something about corrections coming from ND3.
I think I was going to say something about this.
You wrote something.
Oh, I'm just saying, I don't want to draw on this too much, but one way to think about this is the following. The full supergravity description, which I haven't described for you, in fact, does have a singularity of very small radius. It's the same as the singularity that Clifford and Amanda and I talked about. And that's because this system we were talking about this system in the limit that N1 is large and N2 is zero. But the behavior is the same for all those N1 and N2, which is that you really cannot, this object can't exist. You can't actually put all of these things at a point. And if you try to build this thing by moving these different kinds of probe in from infinity, you find that the best you can do is you can make some ring of finite size that carries all your D5 brain charge, and a somewhat larger ring on which some D3 brains are stuck, and somewhat larger ring still on which more D3 brains are stuck. And this goes on either ad infinitum, or actually you can terminate it with some anti-D5 brains. But it corresponds in terms of radius to exactly the same cascade that Klebanoff and Strasser talked about, namely that you can go past this point. There's no question that you can go past this point. And what happens is you get a smaller gauge theory. And also what happens at that point is some fields decouple and
that's the point you just made. You mean that there's another thing?
You can, right. You can. There's radially a series of gauge theories with successively larger gauge groups. It corresponds to the fact that when the gauge coupling gets strong, it's not the end of the world. You simply break part of the gauge symmetry, and you're left with a smaller group at lower energies.
Excuse me, Joe. Yes. Could you remind me? I understand. You have this sort of argument, which is quantum mechanical. The things become massless, and
right,
you can't sort of put them all together and everything. But from the supergravity standpoint, you have
right,
a classical solution. So, is there a stress tensor associated with brains that you see at these radii, or is it just a smooth metric satisfying the usual classical field equations?
From the point of view of the metric, it's smooth. From the point of view of the metric, there's nothing special that happens here.
Okay, so there's no extra stress tensor coming
from
the brain.
No, but there are extra light degrees of freedom on these rings, because when B goes to an integer, you have massless brains. And so what happens is you have these rings of codimension 1 where there are extra massless degrees of freedom live.
Sorry, I'm confused. Why?
Yes.
Oh, because the brains become massless. That's why.
The brains become massless, right.
Well, it's not like massless, they're zero energy. I mean, they're not excited, so they're actually not contributing.
They're not excited, but they're excitable.
Excitable. So if you curved
right,
this, you would see it.
Right. So they're,
the solution
right,
itself.
That's right. So physically there is something going on here, but it doesn't carry any, when it's not excited, it doesn't carry any localized energy.
So the radius of S2 is zero everywhere.
The radius of S2 is zero everywhere. Yes, here.
How do you define theta? How do you measure it?
How do you measure it?
Yes.
With
how
a squid?
How do you measure the flux of B through the line?
With a B squid. it's measurable most directly by the mass that it gives to wrapped D objects.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. these schemes. Okay, so that's, I wanted to have some time to talk about now the Klebanov-Strasser paper.
But then, sorry, when they are masses, they also don't carry any charge, right?
At sorry? That point,
because simultaneously at the time when they are masses, also theta equals zero, and they don't carry any charge.
Right.
So they are not carrying any charge, not have mass, but have only some light fields on their loop.
Well, they still, well, if they still have d5. They still have d5 charge. If you send an object, if you send a d5 brain through this space, it's, well, its mass as measured by the by its metric on moduli space is a function of position, and that's its mass. It doesn't have potential because they're attracted to repulsive forces, but the coefficient of its kinetic curve is feels the deep field. Yeah. Okay. Now, basically, to get to Klebanov-Strasser, to get to the T11, you take this S2 that I've been talking about, and out of infinity, you blow it up. You blow it up a little bit in such a way that it starts to get bigger as you move in. There's a perturbation in the gauge theory. The gauge theory we really have is UN1 cross UN2 mod U. You never see the overall U1 here, but there is a U1 in here. There's a U1 in here, and the because this is an N equals 2 theory, the vector multiplet has the vector and has a chiral superfield, a neutral chiral superfield. And if you give this a mass, that's some perturbation of the Hamiltonian. And if you ask what perturbation, okay, so if you perturb the N equals 2 Hamiltonian, on the supergravity side, you've changed the geometry at infinity. And in particular, what this corresponds to is taking this too small two-sphere and blowing it up a little bit. And blowing it up in a very particular way in terms of how it's, you can blow it up sort of in a vector of directions, and that vector winds as you go around the 4-5 direction. But anyway, you blow up that two-sphere at infinity, and on the supergravity side, that changes you from this space to a space with this topology. And it's not, and presumably which flows in the infrared to this space. On the gauge theory side, you simply break n equals 2 to n equals 1. Let's see, do I need this? No. On the gauge theory side, you break n equals 2 to n equals 1, and you have more or less the same fields. That is, you have basically SUN1 cross SUN2 with a couple of chiral superfields. These are the same fields, but now being described in n equals 1 language. Chiral superfields in the N1, N2 bar, chiral superfields in the N1 bar, N2, where I runs from 1 to 2. And this, by the way, all of the work, most of the work I'm describing was done by Igor Klebanov in a series of papers. I mentioned Klebanov and Strasser, Klebanov and Seitlin, also Klebanov and Gubser, who described how fractional brains gave you N1 not equal to N2. And this is now Klebanov and Witten, who pointed out that this operation on the supergravity side simply corresponds to only to this gauge theory. And one way to see that, and I'm mentioning it for a specific reason, is so this T11 is SU2 cross SU2 cross SU2 cross U1. And, mod U1. Its symmetries are SU2 cross SU2 cross U1. What the SU2 of rough multiplication here on G1 is the SU2 that acts on the A's. And the SU2 of right multiplication here on G2 is the one that acts on the B's. And there's also a U1. The U1 that we modded by acts with opposite signs on the inside here. There's another U1 which acts with the same side. And so it's a symmetry and it commutes with the identification. And so is a U1. So one of the ways that you can make this identification which is an R symmetry because it rotates the gluminos as well. So one of the ways you can make this identification geometrically in a number of other ways is that the symmetry of this gauge theory is the same as the symmetry of this T11 space. Oh, and by the way, it's not real important, but there's a single potential here, which is needed for conformally invariant, and this is one of the special conformally invariant systems that Lee and Strassler described some time ago, based on the exact n equals 1 beta function. Anyway, I'm almost done. So I want to describe now what happens, what the solution looks like. So that it, again, we have the geometry is the following. We've taken, we replaced the S5 with S3 cross S2, and we've turned on this fraction of rain flux on the S3. And again, there is this log in the workflux. But that's not, well, that plays an indirect role, but not a direct role, I'm about to say. But now I want to talk about the nature of the whole solution and the singularity of the solution. So if you take this T11 and make a metric which is just the usual thing where you add a radial direction and the metric of the T11 is multiplied by R squared, this is a conifold. Okay, famous singularity for the L manifolds. By the way, if you want to know more about conifolds, there's a very nice paper by Candelas and De La Osa way back in Nuclear Physics B 342, comments on conifolds, which just collect a lot of facts about this geometry. Anyway, 46. This is a Calabi-Yau manifold, a Ricci flat space, and it has two close neighbors, namely there's the deformed conifold, in which as you approach the base of the sphere, the S2 still contracts to zero, but the S3 remains a finite radius. And there's the resolved conifold, in which the opposite happens. And these are all Ricci flat, and these two are non-singular. This one is singular. Now, it turns out that if you, so here's the field equations you want to solve. And it turns out, rather simply, that if you start from any Ricci flat space, like the conifold or the deformed or resolved conifolds, okay, first of all, the Ricci flat space, of course, solves the field equations. Okay?
That's plus or four trivial dimensions or something.
Plus four trivial dimensions. I should include those. Also now, if you take and you introduce in this space a warp factor, so you multiply this metric by some non-trivial function and the four-dimensional metric by the opposite non-trivial function, it still satisfies the field equations because this is a metric simply of a bunch of D3 brains moving on the previous space. So the field equations require Z to be harmonic, but if Z is not harmonic, it just means that you have a source and the source is a D3 brain. But it turns out there's a simple, yet further generalization which works for all of these, which is that if there is a non-trivial free cycle, if there's a non-trivial free cycle, then there is a harmonic free form. And if you actually, without loss of generality, you can assume that itself dual, or there's an I in there. You can assume that it's imaginary self. By forming linear combinations, you can assume that it's imaginary self dual. But it turns out if you simply take the 2D theory and you turn on a G3 flux, which is proportional to such an omega 3, and you add an extra source term to Z, then again you get a solution to the field equations, which has about the same amount of supersymmetry as this one, which is half as much as this one. And so starting from any of these Ricci flat manifolds, they all have this three cycle, you can first of all add three brains, but in addition you can turn on this flux. And so from all of these you can construct exact solutions to the 2D field equations. Okay. These two are singular. They're singular because the flux is being wrapped on a cycle which is collapsing to zero size. And so the flux goes to infinity. It's a source for the metric. The metric blows up. This one is non-singular. And so this, in fact, is the solution of Kravinoff and Strassler. This is the dual. This is the dual, then, to an N equals 1 gauge theory, which again is SUN1 cross SUN2. The beta function has the same property as the N equals 2 theory, which is that as you go further into the ultraviolet, you keep having the coupling diverge and diverge and diverge. You keep encountering larger and larger gauge groups. So if you really want to take this non-singular geometry and interpret it in terms of quantum field theory, it's got to be a quantum field theory which in the ultimate UV has an infinitely large gauge group, and the gauge group is broken down to smaller and smaller groups until finally in the infrared it breaks down. It reaches sort of a single, you only have a single factor left, and then that confines. There.
So in what sense does this resolve the singularity? It looks like there was never a singularity to start with in this metric.
Okay. Because if you just... So this is the metric that you started with. So by the way, this is the metric here that was described by Kravinoff and Saitlin, yet another collaborator. I think now I've mentioned all five of his collaborators. And this is the one of Kravinoff and Strassler. The reason that you find this one first is if you make an ansatz for the metric, that the full metric has all of the symmetry of the boundary conditions, then this is the solution that you get. And it's singular. If you make an ansatz looking for a solution that has less symmetry, see this, it's not obvious from my pictures, but this has less symmetry than this. This, the deformed manifold is not invariant under the U1 of the undeformed manifold. So this solution, you do.
Are the asymptotic theories the same?
The asymptotic theories are the same. These are the same in the ultraviolet. They're different solutions with the same boundary conditions. And this one is singular and presumably physically inadmissible. This one is non-singular and is presumably the physically admissible one. And there are a number of ways to justify it. One is that it's non-singular. The other is, I said, this solution has less symmetry than the boundary conditions. That's why it was this. That's exactly spontaneous symmetry breaking. The solution, the state, has less symmetry than the Hamiltonian. And the fact that this is the geometry and not this is just a manifestation of chiral symmetry breaking.
But there's an extra parameter.
There's the U1 Goldstone boson. There is the U1 collective coordinate. Now, U1 has to be broken to Z2n by some kind of instanton, which is not something I thought carefully about yet, but I think in the Maldacena and Menya's paper, this is explained, but it seems somewhat intricate. It's some kind of, again, wrapped the instanton. Anyway, so it's very pretty the way, well, first of all, the singularity is resolved in a way which is purely visible in supergravity. You simply have to look for a supergravity ansatz with less symmetry than you might have thought, and it exactly gives you the dual description of chiral symmetry breaking. In fact, just as in my work with Matt, you can figure out what the geometry is doing by going over to the gauge side and looking at the classical field equations. Here, the classical moduli space for this gauge theory is the conifold. But there's an instanton modification of the type that was, and this is an instanton modification of the type that was described by Seiberg. And that instanton modification just exactly is what does that. Now, I don't know how this fits with the M dependence of the instanton, but in fact, if you go back,
but to distinguish between a U1 and C2N, you must take N to be large and finite, right?
Right.
So it makes sense that it's a finite N.
Right. But this picture here, it has nothing to do with the Z2. This picture here is already a statement just about the U1. This is a statement that the U1 breaks. So there's the spontaneous breaking of the U. The U1 breaks both partly spontaneously and partly explicitly. And this picture tells you about the spontaneous breaking. Supergravity knows about the spontaneous breaking, but not about the explicit breaking. Anyway, so it's there.
Excuse me, is there a way of comparing the energy of those two solutions and seeing which one?
Well, they have the same, since they're the same.
Well,
they're
not asking how much they're coming. They can't exactly do the same.
That is an interesting question, but I'm sure that I can find for you in any system singular solutions with less energy than the ground state.
Sure.
And so it's not a matter of comparing solutions. It's really a matter of this being unphysical singularity. It could turn out that this one has more energy than this one, but it's not really relevant. I know there are certainly singular solutions with less energy than the ground state, even in a supersymmetric theory. So, okay.
But it seems that we have a parameter now, which is the size of this energy. How to map? Can it be arbitrary?
There's a deformation parameter here, you say. Right?
That's what I asked. Is there a parameter?
Actually, this is an interesting point, which I don't fully understand. The parameter is related to the total three-way charge and where this cascade ends.
So there is another parameter, which is the flux.
Yeah. There's something that I'm confused by, which is there's a trade-off between having explicit, there's something I'm confused by in the system, which is in some sense the deep free brains that I started with are still there, but this free brain charge is the source for the five form, and in some sense the original free brains are there, but they're hidden in the form of this G wedge G bar background, and so you could say that the amount of deformation is actually determined by the requirement that the integrated G wedge G bar is equal to the total free brain charge you started with. I think that's the right answer.
So the section does not have a horizon?
Doesn't have a horizon. Nope. It's a smooth geometry. It's at the origin, it's just, at the origin, it's just S3 cross R2.
So how better should think about the ESCT based formulas?
Any time you break the conformal invariance, you don't believe there'll be a horizon. When you break the conformal invariance, it introduces a mass gap. You introduce a lower energy scale. And so you don't expect to see an infinite redshift. Similarly, in the work with Strassler, there it's a bit more complicated because the fields are strong near the five brains. But whenever you break the conformal invariance, you don't expect to see a horizon. Okay, so anyway, I've been talking for a while. I think I should stop because this is really the punchline. This is, I think they've done a very nice piece of work here. This is as close as this line of development is likely to get to QCD, where you simply use the duality. Because here you have a theory which has all of the symmetries of QCD, and on the gauge supergravity side, it couldn't be any simpler, a smooth geometry. One of the interesting questions, I'm interested in trying to take some of these things and try to build them into Randall-Sundrup classifications just to see what happens, though I don't expect anything too radical. Also, I was pleasantly surprised that there was this simple pattern to the solutions. And I'd like to understand if this is more general and whether the Maldacena and Nunez solution can somehow be incorporated. Is there some lesson here? This is a nice trick which might have more general applications. And then, of course, there's the question of trying to take GN, G angles N to zero. And in that limit, the whole transverse space here shrinks to zero size. It just becomes a point. And so you're only left with the four non-compact directions in the radial direction. Naively, you're left with a five-dimensional string theory with some kind of hidden degrees of freedom which remember the fact that the string is moving in a zero-size transverse space. Now, that's what Polyakov's been talking about for a long time, of course, that QCD is a five-dimensional string theory with some kind of, you know, non-trivial radial direction. It sounds enough, just trying to take the GN goes to zero limit of the ADS-CFT sounds a lot like what Polyakov's been saying for many years, but it seems like it really takes a lot of cleverness to figure out what that... So there is a limit you can take. And it should be a limit which you can, and in that limit, you should be able to talk about a string as a two-dimensional quantum field theory, no strong string coupling, but a very exotic two-dimensional quantum field theory. In particular, the fact that they are these Ramon fields means that you really can't use the Ramon-Nouveau-Schwarz formula to describe these strings. There is no worldsheet description of the Ramon-Nouveau-Schwarz formalism, most likely. Again, we have the Green-Schwarz formalism, so I suppose that's an existence proof for there being a realization of this. But I've never really managed to understand that. Maybe the light cone. Maybe there's a case where the light cone gauge is the way to describe this, because to avoid the subtleties of the Ramon fields. Anyway, thank you.
So I'm trying to understand the sort of sense of which these asymptotically agree. I mean, if you go back, so in ordinary asymptotically ADS space times, you could take anti-de-Sitter space itself, or you could take Schwarzschild anti-de-Sitter, mm-hmm. and if you take the mass parameter negative, mm-hmm. you get a sort of space time with the naked singularity,
right.
which is asymptotically just right. like anti-de-Sitter.
Right.
Okay, so is that what's going on here? Spacetimes which are just sort of the same to leading order, but there's differences.
That would be a good analogy. I mean, these would be as similar as Schwarzschild negative mass Schwarzschild, for example. The same in infinity at the subleading terms, but one of them is bad for reasons that. One specific sense before you actually reach the apex of the cone here, the time component of the metric goes to infinity. That seems to be characteristic of a lot of the bad singularities that you encounter in these perturbed ADS spaces.
So the singularity actually occurs
here. What happens is this: the three-form flux is diverging. It provides a source for the other fields, and it's exactly the Poisson singularity that Kalosh and Lindy described. That, and so before you actually reach the apex, even before you reach it, the time component of the metric diverges.
Is that going to be resolved like you're
resolved through Poisson? Okay. Well, in the N equals 2 case, it's resolved because that region is excised. In this case, yeah, it's resolved because that infinite source is...
Are you saying the Poisson singularity, the resolution of the Poisson singularity is the same? Is this geometric?
In the N equals 1 case, this has a Poisson singularity, and this is the true picture. So it's resolved geometrically, but it's resolved by taking this, again, by perturbing in a direction which has less symmetry. By taking the nines out for less symmetry,
Zero.